You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. In the next hour, fighting for freedom through football, I'll be joined by the film producer Mark Hoferlin. And is a critical eye and a sharp tongue such a bad thing? We speak to the organiser of a new prize that looks at the best bad reviews. And a storm is brewing for the pottery industry. Or is it just a storm in a teacup? Sales of teapots are declining, according to one retailer. But I'll be joined by one teapot designer who says she's thriving. All that, plus we go ice skating in Holland. And as always, we'll have some carefully curated music to see us through. Today on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The head of the Arab League has said the Syrian army's use of heavy weapons against civilians was an escalation that edged the country towards civil war. In a statement, Nabil al-Arabi said the escalation took the crisis in Syria in a serious direction, adding that it pushed conditions towards a slide towards civil war. Emma Kirby is in Cairo, where the League is considering its next move.
Should they send Arab peacekeepers? Most of them say no. Should they really start to get tough on the level of economic sanctions that they're prepared to impose on Syria? All of that has to be discussed as the killing goes on inside Syria.
Syrian forces bombarded Homs today, killing 50 people in a sustained assault on several districts of the city, which has become a centre of armed opposition to President Assad. Western countries were scrambling to find a new diplomatic strategy after failing to enact a UN Security Council resolution that would have backed an Arab League call for Assad to stand aside. Russia fought back against blistering criticism from the West for vetoing the resolution. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who is due in Damascus tomorrow, said condemnations of Moscow's veto had verged on hysteria. The United States shut its embassy in Damascus and said all staff had left the country due to worsening security. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague said he hoped to increase pressure on Syria, calling the regime doomed and murdering.
In deploying them, they have let down the Arab League. They have increased the likelihood of what they wish to avoid in Syria, civil war. And they have placed themselves on the wrong side of Arab and international opinion.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas must choose either a pact with Hamas or peace with Israel. Rival Palestinian factions, Fatah and Hamas, signed a deal in Qatar to form a unity government of independent technocrats for the West Bank and Gaza, headed by the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. The move, following the failure of exploratory Israeli-Palestinian talks aimed at reviving stalled peace negotiations, was condemned by Israel, who said that Hamas cannot be part of any peace efforts. Egypt's military leadership has called for a swift move to a presidential election, and security forces sealed off the interior ministry in Cairo from stone-throwing protesters clashing with riot police for a fifth day. In a sign that the army's planned transition to civilian rule could be accelerated, the head of the ruling military council, Mohamed Hossein Tantawi, called for a quick completion of the election procedures. President Obama has signed an executive order imposing new stricter sanctions on Iran and its central bank, saying a broader asset freeze was necessary because Iranian banks were concealing transactions. The executive order, described as a further step in the US effort to isolate Iran, prevents any assets deemed to be in US control, including foreign branches of American banks, from being transferred, paid, exported, or withdrawn. Europe's bitterly cold weather has killed another 33 people, and melting snow caused a dam wall to break and flood an entire village in Bulgaria. The cold snap has killed hundreds of people in Europe. 9 died over the past 24 hours in Poland, bringing the total to 62 since the end of January. In Croatia's Dalmatia region, more than 100 villages were cut off by snow in the hinterland of the Adriatic coast, and more snow was forecast. In Ukraine, temperatures have fallen to as low as minus 36 Celsius. This woman was forced into a temporary shelter.
Many thanks to the people running the shelter and all the staff who are looking after us. Otherwise, people would die, and it's good for us here.
Dominican officials are investigating the capsizing of an overloaded immigrant smuggling boat that left 17 people dead and another 20 or missing off the another 20 or more missing off the Dominican Republic coast. And a magnitude 6.7 earthquake has struck the central Philippine island of Negros, triggering landslides that toppled houses and killing at least 12 people, including two children. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. Now it's time for a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffanecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And no end in sight to the European big freeze. This one's definitely going down into the record books. During Tuesday, more snow in the Balkans, also winter weather in northern Greece, Italy and Turkey. Temperatures at night will typically be falling to minus 10, minus 15 degrees across much of the continent, even sub-zero around the Mediterranean. In the United Kingdom, currently a light thaw after the snow we had in London. Actually, London is among the mildest major cities in Europe at present and will remain so for now. Tuesday's city outlook: in London, 2 degrees and sunny, in Zurich, 7 below, partly cloudy. In Vienna, it's 5 below with snow. Barcelona, 9 degrees. The high, sunny, but below zero at night. North America now, and the indications are that slowly the weather will be turning colder across the United States and most parts of Canada. Also, lots of sunshine to come across much of the United States during the week. In California, however, the first half of the week is cool, cloudy, and wet at times. Tuesday's city outlook then: in New York, 10 degrees and sunny. The following day, only 3 degrees. Chicago, 1 Celsius with sunshine. In San Francisco, 13 degrees and rain. And in LA, 15, rain too. Other world destinations now for the next couple of days: in Australia, in Sydney, modest temperatures of around 24, one or two daytime showers around the harbour. Really no significant change here for a while. In Melbourne, similar weather. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffanecker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomash. It's 7 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 lagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e jokoso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Albinos face a very real threat of violence in Tanzania. Their body parts are sought by witch doctors for potions to fight evil. But a group of albinos have decided to use football to fight for the freedom to live alongside their countrymen. It's the topic of one of the documentaries by the director Mark Hofelin, who's on the phone with us now. Mark, firstly, what a heavy subject matter to make a film about. Very harrowing. How did you come to discover that this was happening?
Well, I had been aware about the albino killings for some time before making the film. It was one of those news pieces that I picked up. And I was doing some research in Kenya into some other subjects and for a documentary, none of which were really paying off. And a colleague of mine had said that he'd heard that a group of albinos had formed a football team in Dar es Salaam, and so we headed down to Dar es Salaam by bus just to see them and check it out, and we spent a bit of time with them and realized that it would make quite a good film.
Now, without going into too much graphic detail, Mark, the sort of threat that's faced by these albinos is quite a shocking one, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think there have been a lot of albino murders over the last 4 or 5 years, and the spate of killings has gone down, which is a good thing. But the one thing that no one really takes into consideration is the fact that a lot of them are maimed. They manage to get away. So what you see is a lot of albino population with missing arms or legs or fingers or body parts where they have managed to get away. And whilst the number is under 100 of killed albinos, the number runs far higher than that, into many hundreds, as to those that have been maimed.
So what is the belief then? Why do witch doctors want their body parts?
Well, I think this is one of those kind of things that in Tanzania and in other countries, it goes round in a bit of a circle. It's the new fad, if you like. And 4 or 5 years ago, witch doctors started peddling the myth that the body parts of albinos, the hairs and the bones, if ground up into powders or the hairs put into fishnets, would make for good luck potions and bring wealth and good luck. And the witch doctors are held in such high esteem, the traditional healers, that people will believe them. And before the albinos, I think it was old people, bald old people, something like that, who were seen as good luck charms and who were hunted down. So in effect, the albino trend is something that has come about in the last 4 or 5 years and hopefully will die out. The sad thing is that it may be taken by something else.
Yes, why is it the witch doctors are held in such high regard? They have a grip on the people and people look at them as if they have all the answers. Why is that?
Well, I think traditionally, you're going back to a time where in these rural parts of Africa, you've got a traditional society in which the traditional healer plays a vital part. And traditional healing, in effect, isn't such a foreign concept here. I mean, we have various herbal remedies for different things. In effect, that's what the traditional healer or the witch doctor does, and those traditional methods do work. I mean, you can cure a headache with certain leaves and so forth. And this is just a kind of a portion of that witch doctor community who is deciding to kind of cash in on their respect, on their, you know, of their villages. So they are the ones who come up with these ideas that can make them a lot of money.
When you're faced with that level of widespread belief then in an idea, how did these men break through that through football?
Well, what was interesting with first of all, the connotations of albinos in Tanzania is that they can't do anything, and in part that's due to the fact that they can't go outdoors very often because of the sunlight can easily burn their skin. So a lot of them tend to stay indoors, and people kind of have this mystical belief that therefore, you know, you never really see them, you don't know who they are. So that's what people believe, and what the football team is trying to do is to travel around these dangerous parts of Tanzania and play football and attract a crowd. And obviously a big crowd comes whenever there's a football match on anyway. It's a good form of entertainment, and a traveling team it always makes for good fun. The fact that these are albinos makes them even more curious. And when the matches start, you can very clearly see that they are, the crowd is jeering and laughing at them. And by the end of the match, they're supporting them. And it's quite a wonderful thing. And that is the best way to educate the kind of people in that area.
It humanizes them, in effect.
Completely, yes. I think the crowds watching can actually relate to them and talk to them and see that they're no different to the other people.
You filmed this a couple of years ago now, Mark. Do you think the situation for Tanzanian albinos has improved at all since then?
I think the killings have gone down, in part because sentences were passed down where people were found guilty and were effectively actually convicted, sentenced to death by hanging, although that will never actually happen. Last hanging in Tanzania was 20 years ago. But the murders have gone down. The attacks still continue, though, and that's what needs to kind of eventually stop. I think the situation has improved, but it's still obviously a far way from being perfect, and the stigmatization that they face as being second-class citizens still exists.
Mark Hoefeland, thank you very much for joining us. That was Mark Hoefeland, the director of the film Albinos United, which you can see in London at the moment at the Frontline Cinema. It's time for a song now. This is Here We Go Magic and Tunnel Vision. That was Here We Go Magic. The song was Tunnel Vision. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be hearing what makes a bad review good. We'll be back right after this.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and Shop at the new Hank Hugh Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the Peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marinucci. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 now. A book critic's review can make or break a writer's career, and now a new literary prize aims to reward the art of scathing reviews. The Hatchet Job of the Year prize is a nod to the most cutting and critical reviews of lackluster literature. This year's winner will be announced tomorrow. I'm joined tonight by Fleur MacDonald, one of the award organisers. How are you, Fleur?
Very well, thank you.
Now, you're actually from the site which aggregates these reviews for all to see, and I guess handpicks some of the most biting, as it were. The name of your site is theomnivore.co.uk.
Yeah, we're from The Omnivore, and so we aggregate book reviews.
What made you decide to come up with this Hatchet Job of the Year award?
Well, it's basically a lot of fun. That's the fun answer. The more serious answer is that we wanted to raise the profile of professional critics. Because those, and we wanted to promote literary debate as well.
It's not an easy job, is it, to review books? It would be easy to just say nice things about them and get more free books. It's quite brave to go out there and you know, take jibes at an author who may be already well established.
Exactly, and you know, they're probably your friend, and you probably bumped into them at a party the night before. And you probably know their publisher, and you probably share an agent, as in it's a very cliquey world. We wanted to highlight that and reward those reviewers that are heroic enough to say what they really think.
Yeah, to break through all the kind words.
And exactly.
It's a fine line though, isn't it? How do you avoid offending the entire audience and the wider market and the community, the literary community, or being seen as very bland and not saying much at all, really, in your reviews?
Exactly. I think that, you know, there have been a few people that have been offended by the prize, but I think that shows that we've been doing our job properly. I think that when you're an author, actually, you've got to be prepared to brave whatever comes your way. If you're going to publish a book, you've got to be ready for the reaction.
And we're told criticism's good for us.
Makes
our product better.
Exactly. And I mean, we've been very careful in terms of picking the nominees and the reviews that we thought were the best hatchet jobs of 2011. So we haven't chosen any reviews about books that are by debut novelists, because that's just not fair.
Scare them back into the woods.
Exactly.
They'll never write again.
Exactly. And I mean, maybe for some of them, that's probably a good idea. But for others, the first book is basically an experiment.
Yes, so, and you should encourage them to open up.
Exactly.
I suppose the ones that should know better, and they release something that could be seen as sloppy or lazy, and it's a firm, sharp lesson to them, isn't it?
Exactly. You know? So we've tried to go for well-established authors. Do you want me to talk through the reviews?
Please, Fleur.
We've picked 8 reviews, and we've picked them because they've been targeting well-known authors. For example, Booker Prize winner Julian Barnes, The Sense of an Ending, that got demolished in the New York Times by Jeff Dyer.
What was said?
He basically, I think it's probably the worst praise a reviewer, an author could ever receive. Excellent in its averageness.
Oh, lovely.
And Jeff Dyer has obviously read a lot of Julian Barnes's previous work and knows exactly what he's talking about when it comes to unpicking exactly why it wasn't such a good book. And well, that's a great review. And all of the, to be honest, all of the other reviews for that book were, they were praising it to high heaven. So it was nice to get a lone voice.
It really didn't see the hype at all.
Exactly. And so we've got Leo Robson on the Martin Amis biography by Richard Bradford.
Right.
And funnily enough, actually, one of our judges, DJ Taylor, I really shouldn't say this, but he's very good friends with Richard Bradford, said author. So we've tried to be as unbiased as possible in terms of selecting the reviews.
Anyway, yeah, the critic might not burn his bridges, but you guys might.
Yeah, exactly, our judges.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so Leo Robson, who's an up-and-coming reviewer, he... quotation we liked the most was spectacularly bad writing about spectacularly good writing. And I think that really sums up why reviewers have to be careful, because if they're going to criticize someone's work, they've got to make sure that they know what they're talking about.
They're open to criticism themselves.
Exactly.
Of course.
Yeah. And I mean, the other people that have been nominated for the prize include Mary Beard, the well-known classicist, and she reviewed Robert Hughes's book on Rome, and it's riddled with errors, and she's the one that spotted it. I mean, I wouldn't know that the Colosseum was born after Nero's was built after Nero's birth, and Mary Beard had to tell me that Pompey didn't come after Augustus; he came before Augustus.
Right.
And actually, that book is also interesting because it's actually getting published in the US, but the publishers haven't changed any of the errors that Mary Beard spotted.
It's interesting to know whether or not there are any books in which the criticism has been taken on board for future editions and has been amended.
Well, hopefully Hatchet Job is going to change that.
One of those, yeah.
Hopefully it will. And so who else do we have? We have Adam Mars-Jones on Michael Cunningham, who wrote The Hours, which was made into that successful film. And I think that's actually a really good example of an author who coats his work with literary references. It's sort of like being at a party and you've got someone who's name-dropping next to you and, you know, says, I know so-and-so, so-and-so. So Michael Cunningham, according to Adam Mars-Jones, who's the reviewer, quotes Flaubert, the same line from Flaubert, three times in the space of one chapter, and he doesn't even get the translation right. So we really need these reviewers to tell us that sometimes we're reading rubbish.
It's a noble job.
Exactly.
And it's one that I'm sure a lot of people think they could do. But when it comes down to writing a review themselves, it's not so easy. It's that fine balance. Have you ever tried reviewing books yourself?
Yes, I have.
A keen reviewer.
But I'm terrified now.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. Terrified. You'll be shot down in flames by either the author or fellow reviewers.
Or Hatchet Job next year.
Absolutely. So how can we find out more about Hatchet Job now?
Well, I would go to www.hatchetjoboftheyear.com, and I'd also check out the reviews on theomnivore.co.uk because, well, as I said before, a lot of these books have been reviewed really well. So if you want to see both sides of the picture, we've aggregated all the reviews for you.
Fleur, thank you ever so much for coming in tonight. It's time for some music. This is Gruff Rhys and the song is Vitamin K.
I'm saved because she said goodbye. So long, it's time to die.
That was Vitamin K by Gruff Rhys. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be getting a global look ahead with Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. We'll also be finding out why ice skaters in Holland are getting excited. But first, here's the news with Nick Claley.
The head of the Arab League has said the Syrian army's use of heavy weapons against civilians was an escalation that edged the country towards civil war. Syrian forces bombarded Homs today, killing 50 people in a sustained assault on several districts of the city, which has become a centre of armed opposition to President Assad. Rival Palestinian factions Fatah and Hamas have signed a deal in Qatar to form a unity government of independent technocrats for the West Bank and Gaza, headed by the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas. Egypt's military leadership has called for a swift move to a presidential election, and security forces sealed off the interior ministry in Cairo from stone-throwing protesters, clashing with riot police for a fifth day. US President Barack Obama has signed an executive order imposing new, stricter sanctions on Iran and its central bank. The Romanian Prime Minister Emil Bloch resigned today, giving way to mass protests against IMF-backed austerity measures. The president has nominated the intelligence service head Mihai Răzvan Ungureanu as prime minister. His nomination will be needed. Will need parliamentary approval. European shares ended lower today as worries grew about a messy Greek debt default, with political leaders in Greece yet to decide on the terms of a second bailout. Europe's bitterly cold weather has killed another 33 people, and melting snow caused a dam wall to break and flood an entire village in Bulgaria. Dominican officials are investigating the capsizing of an overloaded immigrant smuggling boat that left 17 people dead and another 20 or more missing off the Dominican Republic coast. And a magnitude 6.7 earthquake has struck the central Philippine island of Negros, triggering landslides that toppled houses and killed at least 12 people. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. Now it's time to speak to Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, about what stories are shaping up to be the big ones of the world this week. Welcome, Steve.
Hello.
How are you? You doing? Doing all right?
Very good.
Long
very
day
good
for
day.
You, dear boy, isn't
always
it?
Is. Always is.
Always is.
Should we start with Syria?
Well, it seems to be the one everybody's talking about at the moment. The world seems to be divided, doesn't it?
It does indeed. And so I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in the next few days. With Syria, and in particular looking at how the rest of the world responds. I think as we talked earlier on the briefing, let's not pretend that this UN resolution, if it passed, would have necessarily done a huge amount to actually solve the situation, but no. It would have sent a good signal.
Will countries pay attention to it, or will some decide to intervene anyway?
Well, exactly, and I think the West now is trying to work out how it intervenes. And when we say intervene, obviously, I mean, they're not going to intervene militarily. That's completely, off the table. But there are some things. One is sanctions. Already, William Hague, the British Foreign Minister, was talking today about 11 rounds of sanctions with the EU. Done through the EU that will happen with Syria. There's also going to be issues over, do they start surreptitiously arming the opposition? Is that one of the options? Will Turkey perhaps decide to arm the opposition?
Yeah.
Does Turkey consider creating some sort of safe zone, some sort of buffer zone inside Syria? These are all things.
It's already home to one of the big opposition groups, isn't it?
It is indeed.
The Syrian National Council.
And I think the other issue is going to be what happens to the Arab League, because the Arab League has had Qatar have been chairing it, the meetings, and Qatar had a very strong view of what should happen. They said, this has to end, Assad needs to go. They had the support of Saudi Arabia. The next Arab League summit is going to be in Baghdad, and Iraq, firstly, has its own issues, internal issues, without having to... without necessarily the time or inclination to get involved in foreign policy debates at the moment. And also their view on Syria, it's more of a Shia-dominated government. They're going to be less inclined to get involved. So it's going to be quite messy. It's going to be quite difficult to navigate a way through. Obviously something that we have to keep our eye on.
Another messy situation, and bound to be a lot of mudslinging with the French elections coming up.
Yes, slightly less violent, but yes.
Just as dirty.
Possibly, yeah. What's fascinating, or what I find fascinating about the French poll, is that this is the first election in several years, anywhere in the world, where you've had two very different political ideologies going head-to-head. The socialist candidate, François Hollande, has laid out a very sort of strong centre-left view of manifesto, which includes increasing tax on the rich and using that money to pay for finding 150,000 jobs for young people and also improve funding for schools. It's a classic sort of left-wing manifesto of the sort that we haven't really seen in any major country for a while. So this is going to do two things, if Hollande wins, that is. One, it completely changes what's happening in Europe, because Hollande differs massively with Angela Merkel, so much so that Merkel is perhaps even going to campaign with Sarkozy.
Well, and it makes you wonder whether or not that's wise.
Well,
to do so,
yes.
Hollande is seeming like the most, the biggest threat to Sarkozy at this stage.
Exactly. So there's that issue. The other thing, so it'll cause wide changes in European policy.
Yeah.
The other issue is what it does for the European left more broadly. If Hollande proves that it's possible for a left-wing party to win on a relatively traditional left-wing ticket of tax and spend, if you want to be so crude. Will the SPD in Germany, when their election comes up in 2013, take a similar tack? Will Ed Miliband in the UK and the Labour Party take a similar tack? Will Barack Obama, even later this year, and we're already seeing the beginnings of that, trying to put forward a very different path forward from the Republicans.
So it could potentially have ripple effects across the continent.
I think it really could. I mean, this will be the first time, I say, you know, in previous elections, there's been a sort of a coming together. I mean, there's still differences, obviously, between the left and the right, but more of a coming together. That might change.
And a lesser-known election has been going on in Senegal. Tell us a bit about that.
Indeed. So Senegal's elections are at the end of this month, the 26th of February. Senegal has had a relatively good democratic record, certainly as far as Africa is concerned. The president, Abdoulaye Wade, has just finished his second term. He's 85 years old. Constitutionally, he's not allowed to run for a third term. However, the court, which is partly stacked with his loyalists, has decreed that because this two-term rule was brought in after his original inauguration, he isn't bound by it. So he is running for a third term. The opposition say, well, if he does go ahead and run for a third term, we want no part in this election. One of the most high-profile opposition candidates, Youssou N'Dour, the singer, has already had his candidacy blocked. And when the Constitutional Court last week announced that they were overturning this rule and saying what it could run, there are huge demonstrations. Four people were killed. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the coming weeks, because a lot of people across Africa and outside are watching this very closely indeed.
Yes, I'm sure it won't be wrapped up anytime soon. It may roll on for quite some time. Steve, thank you very much. That was Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Right, we'll be soon pouring out a cup of tea, if you'd like to stay for that, Steve. We'll be talking to teapot designer
Ali Miller.
You deserve one after that.
I would like a cuppa. I might stick around for that.
Well, we'll have to see if he does stay. We'll be back right after this.
So pack your cigarettes and your A to Z. It'll be just like that book you read.
That was A to Z by Tracy Thorne. Well, there's a freshly brewed pot of tea right in front of me, and I am joined by Ali Miller. We'll be back right after this.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the design section, we take a closer look at charm and profile 10 companies around the world that are nailing it. We also kick back on the beach in New Zealand in Herbst Architect's latest creation.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, according to the British retailer Debenhams, the sale of teapots is in decline. Sales in the UK are down by 39% compared to 5 years ago. So is it a storm brewing for the industry, or is it just a storm in a teacup? In the studio now, we have the designer of teapots and tea sets, I'm told, the artist Ali Miller. And is this your set in front of us now?
It is, yes.
It's lovely. So what's it? It's got a teapot on it. There's a picture of a teapot on it.
It does. This one particularly that I brought in today was actually designed specially for the Tate Alice in Wonderland exhibition in Liverpool just a few months ago. And I designed this specially for them, so I'm quite excited to also be working in the Tate.
Absolutely, quite a client to have there.
Absolutely, yeah.
What made you get involved in designing tea sets? Have you always loved tea?
I have. My artwork is very much about my home, and as I'm British and have a lot of influence with the British industry, I was
inspired to make tea sets and everything for the home as a quintessentially British product. So it just made sense to make artwork that was British and then make British products.
What is British design now? Are we going back to old designs, and do we like that quaint feel?
Well, very much so, which is why I like this, because most of my work is about memory, nostalgia, and kind of quintessentially fun and quirky things. So for me, it's a combination of new and old together that creates a new design, and yeah, where we are today, I hope.
I suppose when you look at the mass market, and when you hear from retailers like Debenhams saying that the sale of teapots is on the decline, I suppose the mass market now, they've bought into things like coffee machines and cafetières even. I mean, I've got a cafetière at home and I don't have a teapot, and yet I love a cup of tea, but I tend to have one with a mug.
Well, there's nothing wrong with hugging a mug.
No, that's true. It's quite comforting, isn't it? Especially on cold days like these. But what is it about a teapot and a tea set that brings people together?
I think that's exactly it. It's the bringing together, isn't it? It's the social aspect. Bring your friends round, have tea with the girls, have a cup of tea with a teacup and saucer, cakes with your friends.
Have some cakes, exactly. That's the idea of a party with tea cakes and tea. That's very in at the moment, isn't it? That's
absolutely. Very trendy. The social aspect of it all is what's very much draws me to making products like this, is having something to talk about around the dinner table. And obviously, the more and more we can sit around the dinner table instead of sitting in front of the TV while we eat and drink and be social while we do those things as a family and with friends.
Are you interested in designing things more for the mass market, or do you prefer to design one-off pieces for more niche clients?
I very much try to kind of cover everybody and have pieces that I make, one-off bespoke pieces, which I can, which then no one else will have. And that's for the top end. And people like Paul Smith sell those products there. And then I'll make stuff that can then go into the Tate and Selfridges, where then more people can have something. And that's kind of either a limited edition amount in which people can then also enjoy pieces there.
So a bit of both, really.
Yeah, trying to make sure that no one loses out on having a good cup of tea.
Where do you see the tea market moving forward going? Do you see the design? I mean, your design teapot there, it's very classic in its design. It's what you'd imagine 50 years ago, and you've just added certain elements to it, like the butterflies on the spout there. That's very cute. How will we see drastic changes? We've already seen through the 80s, the 70s as well, you know, real Art Deco style takes of the teapot. Will we keep going back to that design in front of us there?
Well, I think that's the warm, comforting, if you're actually talking about the actual shape of it, the classic one, it's the nostalgia that we like. So all I've done is try to play on that by putting more quirky new images onto the products themselves.
Now, while this tea is standing in front of us, I'm a bit concerned that it's going cold. Is there a cup there that we can pour a bit out into?
You can. Would you like some in there?
Yeah, I would love some. Beautiful. Oh, it is still hot. It's steaming. Yeah. Lovely. It's going into... I did have the remnants of an old cup still in there.
Yeah.
This is very nice. So you design other things as well surrounding the tea set. You have like little aprons, and do you make tea cozies?
That's actually something I would like to start looking into right now, actually. Yes.
Well, this is perfect. What's in this?
I don't know, I think it's ginger.
It's one of our herbal ones. She doesn't make the tea bags, she just makes the teapots. She doesn't know what tea's in there. Of course, no, this is one of our monocle herbal ones. I'm trying to decipher what this is. It's nice, it's good on the throat for a winter night.
Cozy, cozy.
Well, thank you ever so much for that, and thank you for pouring me this tea.
My pleasure.
Miller, thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
Right, we will be back in a second with a song, but you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And soon we'll be crossing to Holland, where ice skaters are hoping to revive a winter tradition there. First a song, Lindstrom and Christabel with Music in My Mind. That was Lindstrom and Christabel with Music in My Mind. Now, in the Netherlands, there's anticipation in the crisp winter air, thanks to an Arctic blast of cold air sweeping across Europe. Many of Holland's lakes and rivers have frozen up. And if that continues, it means the Dutch will be able to revive a tradition dating back to 1909. The Elfstedentocht ice skating race hasn't been held for 10 years because conditions have been too mild. Elfstedentocht stands for 11 Cities Tour. It's almost 200 kilometres long, and it's conducted on frozen canals, rivers and lakes between 11 historic Dutch cities. On the phone, we can now speak to an athlete who's competed in the race three times, Bart Veldkamp. Hello there. Bart, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Right. Thank you very much for joining me. Now, I'm sure we're all wondering, what is Elfstedentocht? How did it come about? And why do people still take part?
It started actually in the late 1800s. It was kind of a bet that they were saying, well, I bet you that I can skate around the province and pass all the main cities. They had 11 cities in this province, and the bet was to go past them in one day.
Now, it's not been held since, is it 1997? So it's more than 10 years. Has that been because conditions have simply been too mild?
Yeah, it's totally natural ice, so it's all depending on the weather. And yeah, the ice must be at least 15 to 20 centimeters thick. So that takes time and real cold temperatures to let that happen.
I'd imagine what makes this so special is the distances involved. I mean, 200 kilometers, taking in 11 towns and cities. How on earth is an event like this organized?
Yeah, it's one big loop. For the athletes, it's a long trip. It depends also a lot on the weather. Sometimes there's no wind, sometimes a lot of wind, so the ice can be very good. Like right now, the ice is actually good, so it looks like it can be a good one now. But like in 63, the racers took 10.5 hours.
Wow.
And these days, the racers do like 6.5 hours.
They're getting quicker.
Yeah, like in everything, yeah.
Now, when you're on the race, what's the atmosphere like? Have you got people lining the race route as you go along?
Yeah, actually the whole Holland is getting crazy.
Sounds like Tour de France on ice.
Yeah, exactly. Days like that, like 2.5 million people will come over to the race track, to the tour, and stand there and cheer at the people. So it will be a lot of spectators, and yeah, it's such a special event as a skater. There's nothing comparable with it. So yeah, it's... Yeah, people get crazy and stand there from 5:30 in the morning until 12 at night to cheer the people on.
Wow, why are people so enthused by this event?
Yeah, the Dutch have the intention to go on the ice as soon as it's possible. Everybody that's actually never skates, but when it's freezing, the canals are frozen, then they put on skates and everybody goes out. No matter who, no matter what, we all get equal. If you're like a policeman, a politician,
mm-hmm.
An athlete, everybody goes on the ice. And that makes the Dutch feel real Dutch again. And that's why the whole nation gets excited.
I'm told it's even been graced by royalty over the years.
Yeah. The royal family is always traditionally at the finish line. The queen has always been standing there to give the winner the prize. And even the prince, who will be the king after Queen Beatrix raced the race in 86.
Now, how do you make sure that the ice is thick enough and strong enough for this race to be carried out? What are they doing to prepare this?
Like the whole track, the 200 kilometer is split up in 22 sections, and every section has his headman that checks the ice, take the necessary things to make it better or to clean it. And every once in a while, they make a report. Like yesterday, they had a meeting with those 22 people. They come with a report, and on Saturday again. So the whole route is checked. A lot of volunteers are involved to clean the ice with brushes and everything. So, yeah, we'll see. It's depending on the weather and what the news will be on Saturday.
Our hope's pretty high at the moment.
Yeah, everybody is counting Saturday will be the race, or Monday. So it's, yeah, You know how that goes, you know, rumours everywhere.
Is it for everybody? I mean, I'm sure it's not for the faint-hearted. Does it get quite manic, or is there a fun element as well? Is it purely competitive, or do people sort of trail behind and take their time with it like they do with marathons?
Yeah, it's a little bit like the marathon. You have like three, four hundred people, they are competing in a race, and they have numbers on their legs, and that's an official race. After that, there come about 15,000 people just doing the tour. And you have to be a member of the club who's organizing it. And they have like 30 or 35,000 members. So you are drafted. And so you're lucky to be in one of the 15,000.
Now, Bart, I know you went to the one in 1997. Did you take part in that one, or did you just watch?
No, I took part in the last three. And the last one I was doing the race. So, yes, I have good memories on this event, even though it was terribly heavy, but, yeah.
how did you do then? Did you rank quite highly?
Yeah, pretty okay. I'm actually a long track skater, so I do, like, track and field, but then on the ice. That's something very different than this. So I just competed because I'm so fanatic about it, and I ended up 29th, so that was good for me. And it was the first time I was happy with not winning, that I just made it.
And are you going to take part this time if it happens?
Yeah, this time I'm just competing as a tourist and enjoy the scenery and make it to the finish.
So, just for kicks, just for fun?
Yeah, just for fun, yeah. My days for competition are behind me. And now it's just the thrill of being one of the 15,000 and make it to the finish.
Oh, well, I wish you all the best. Bart Velkamp, thank you ever so much for speaking to us. That was the ice skater, Bart Velkamp. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Londonból, ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から, Monocle 24 です.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα, tämä on Monocle 24.
Λονδόν, burası Monocle 24.
London から, Monocle 24.
Well, we're out of time for this Monday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. In 3 hours' time, it's time for the Monocle Daily with Tom Burgess-Watson and Chloe Potter at 2200 hours. Headlines are next on Monocle 24.